Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to tackle the second half of Psalm 78. The first half of Psalm 78, verses 1 through 35, I covered in the last audio. I called that audio, Tell the Coming Generation That God Saved Israel. Now, the first 35 verses just talk about basically a rehash of the Exodus, all the wonderful things that God did during that time. And then the psalmist goes on to say, but Israel sinned. And then God, in verse 34, after God killed them, then the Israelites sought him, and they returned and searched diligently for God. So they repented, and they remembered that God was the rock and the Most High God, their Redeemer. So things are hunky-dory. But now, as we start in verse 36, we're going to see that the Israelites are back to their sinful ways again, but they deceived him with their mouth and lied to him with their tongue, etc., etc. So we're going to start out on a negative note here. The sons of Israel are once again sinning against their God. Now, I'm not going to go over the introduction to the psalm. I did that in the last audio. But remember, this is a psalm of Asaph, who was either David's first appointed Levite in charge of worship, or it was a descendant of his. The scholars are not sure. I'm just going to call him Asaph instead of saying the psalmist all the time. So we start now in verse 36, and I'll read through verse 39. But they, that's the Israelites, deceived him with their mouth and lied to him with their tongue, for their heart was not steadfast toward him, toward Yahweh, nor were they faithful in Yahweh's covenant. But God, being compassionate, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. And often he restrained his anger and did not arouse all his wrath. Thus he remembered they were but flesh, a wind that passes and does not return. So here we see the oft-noted characteristic of God, that he's slow to judge. He gives time for people to repent. He lets a lot of sin go on before he finally judges it, and the cup of his iniquity is filled up. And he says, okay, I've had it. And he pours out the cup of his iniquity, the wine of his fierce wrath, on the people who are sinning. But here the Israelites have not reached that point. God has forgiven them. Now, verse 36, the psalmist Asaph says that the Israelites lied to God with their tongue. If you think about it, that's pretty dumb, to lie to an omniscient God. I mean, really, what kind of lie are you going to tell him that God's not going to know about? Of course he knew about it. In verse 37, Asaph says that the Israelites were not faithful in his covenant. That would be the covenant at Mount Sinai when the law was given. They broke the law constantly. Verse 38, but he, God, being compassionate, forgave their iniquity. This sentiment is also reflected in Psalms 85. This psalm was written by the sons of Korah. You forgave the iniquity of your people. You covered all their sin. God is a forgiving God. This is another verse for those who say that the Old Testament God is not gracious and merciful. He's a tyrant. He's evil. He's hard. He's unjust. He's unforgiving. On the contrary, the end of verse 38 says, often God restrained his anger and did not arouse all his wrath. Some of his wrath, maybe. A little bit of punishment, but it was not complete wrath, because complete wrath will destroy its object. Verse 39, thus he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes and does not return. In other words, God took into account the Israelites' weaknesses, not only physical weaknesses, but even their moral weaknesses. When God says the Israelites were flesh, John Gill says they were poor, frail, weak, mortal creatures, unable to bear the weight of his displeasure. And they were just like a wind that passes and does not return. It's a great metaphor. Used in other places, Job 7:7, remember that my life is but breath or wind. My eye will not again see good. Your life is just like a breath of wind or breath from a human being. Not much. Can't see it. It passes, it comes, it goes, and is gone. Psalm 103:16, written by David, when the wind has passed over the flower of the field, it is no more, and its place acknowledges it no longer. In other words, that flower says, well, that wind felt really good, but it's gone now. So that's the way life is. It's over in a flash. And so God took account of that weakness of the Israelites and says, I'm going to forgive you one more time. We go now to Psalm 78, verses 40 through 41. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. Again and again they tempted God and pained the Holy One of Israel. The NIV says how often they put him to the test. They put God to the test. Here's a scripture in the law that says that the Israelites tested God 10 times, Numbers 14:22. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice. Well, at the first part of verse 40, how often they rebelled against him. Notice the often. It wasn't just a one-time rebellion. It was over and over and over again. Now, the 10 times mentioned in Numbers 14:22 might not be precise. It might just signify a whole bunch of times, which I suspect it does, because I bet you if you sat down and counted all the times that Israel tested God, you could come up with more than 10. Verse 41 says that the Israelites pained God, the Holy One of Israel, who is, of course, Yahweh. The NIV says they vexed God. Now, here's another scripture from Isaiah 63:10, but they rebelled and grieved his Holy Spirit. Not God, but the Holy Spirit was grieved. Well, now, we have a problem here. Classical theology says that God does not experience emotions because he's impassible. That's the theological word. God is the blessed God. His happiness is complete. He doesn't feel the pain. Impassible passion means emotion. Impassible means no emotion. That's a problem. What? God's not an emotional God? Does that mean he's a robot? How can he feel our emotions if he doesn't have emotion? And besides, the scripture here says he was pained. That's an emotion. Well, let me read you what JimmyAiken.com says. Jimmy Akin is a Catholic. He says, scripture also speaks of God experiencing sadness and anger, but Christian theology has historically understood this to be non-literal language. God in his divine essence experiences infinite beatitude, and this beatitude would be marred if he experienced anguish in his divine essence. This is analogous to the way in which, once we are glorified in heaven, we will be aware of the fact that not all humans are saved, but it will not ruin heaven for us. Now, of course, that's a question that I'm sure you thought about a lot. Do people in heaven know about their unsaved loved ones going to hell? And if they do know about it, how can they be completely happy since in heaven there's not going to be any sadness? My answer to that's always been people in heaven aren't going to know about it. They're not going to care about the people who went to heaven, even if they were close to them on this earth. But I'm just speculating. I don't know. I could be wrong. Jimmy Akin says, nah, you'll know they're in hell, but it won't bother you that they're in hell because you will see that it's perfectly just. I don't know. That's pretty difficult. Now, here's what Matt Slick of Carm says about this difficult theological problem. Quote, God does experience emotions. He loves, hates, grieves, rejoices, etc. But can he suffer? Again, this is a difficult question to answer because we do not know if suffering with God is the same as with us. GotQuestions.org chips in with this comment, God does have emotions, but he does not have mood swings. Well, you can see from the authorities that basically they're saying anytime God has an emotion in the scripture, it's expressed anthropomorphically as humans would express it, but that God is not experiencing the same thing because he's impassible. He doesn't suffer emotions, at least in the same way we do. But then this is hedged by people saying, yeah, but on the other hand, he suffers in a way that we don't really understand. It's a God type of suffering. That doesn't really satisfy me, but that's the best I can do right now. Let's put it this way. God doesn't like it when people rebel against him. We go down to Psalm 78, verses 42 through 48. They, that's the Israelites, did not remember God's power, the day when God redeemed them from the adversary, when God performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the field of Zoan, and turned their rivers to blood and their streams they could not drink. He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them, and frogs which destroyed them. He gave also their crops to the grasshopper, and the product of their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hailstones and their sycamore trees with frost. He gave over their cattle also to the hailstones and their herds to bolts of lightning. This is obviously referring to what God did to the Egyptians with the 10 plagues. These miraculous events were not remembered by Israel. The day, in verse 42, the day when God redeemed them from the adversary, in other words, by getting them out of Egypt after Passover night, Passover lamb sacrifice, blood on the lintels of the door, marching through the Red Sea. No, they forgot all that. Now, the day when he redeemed them from the adversary, you could just interpret day as being a general time, the time when he redeemed them from the adversary, but you could interpret it as being the precise day, the day that the Exodus started. Here's what John Gill says. That very memorable day in which they were delivered out of his hands, that selfsame day which had been fixed by promise and prophecy many hundreds of years before, in which the host of the Lord went out of Egypt. Now, what Gill is referring to here is the prophecy made in the famous covenant with Abraham, Genesis 15:13. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know this for certain, your offspring with foreigners in a land that does not belong to them, they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. Now it says 400, some places it says 430 years. In fact, in Exodus 12:41, which Gill also refers to, we read this, "And at the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." Now, the calculation of that 400/430 years and the reconciliation of the two numbers is a bodacious exegetical problem, which I've already tackled in Exodus 12:41, and I think also in Genesis 15:13. I don't remember what I said because it was so complicated. I'll have to go back and review it, but not here. The point is that the appointed time, whether it's just an appointed time in general or whether it's to the very 24-hour day, it was a day appointed by God to redeem them from Egypt. And they didn't remember that, the Israelites didn't. And then in verses 43 through 47, various signs in Egypt are mentioned. Verse 43, "When he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the field of Zoan." Zoan was the city on one of the eastern branches of the Nile River in the delta there, near the border of southern Israel, there in the land of Goshen, where the Israelites started out from on the Exodus. That's why Zoan is mentioned there. The city is lost now. They don't know exactly where it is. And in verse 44, "God turned their rivers to blood." Well, that would be the Nile River and its seven streams, as John Gill points out, because the Nile branches into all those streams there at the north, at the very end of the river, the northern end of the river. "So God turned their rivers to blood." Of course, that's the famous plague on the Nile, when the Nile was turned to a blood-red color. As we go through these verses, as John Gill points out, we will see that 7 of the 10 plagues on Egypt are listed right here by Asaph. They're not in the same order as listed in the Torah, in the law, but they are there. So the rivers were turned to blood, and their streams, that could refer to the canals that were dug by the men to water the fields, dug from the Nile into the fields. They couldn't drink because the water was polluted. Verse 45, "He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them." How did the flies devour them? Well, the flies killed their crops. They caused pestilence, which then, of course, killed some of the Egyptians. So they were being devoured. They were being destroyed by frogs. At the end of verse 45, "How can frogs destroy you?" John Gill says, "By their stench." Well, have you ever smelled a dead frog? I have, and oh boy, do those babies stink. They stink horribly. And if you got a whole land covered with dead frogs, oh my gosh, it's a good way to put it. They were destroyed. In verse 36, the psalmist says that God gave the Israelites' crops to the grasshopper and the product of their labor to the locust. That's probably Hebrew parallelism there, grasshopper in parallel with locust, because a grasshopper is a kind of a locust. If you look at a locust, it looks awfully like a grasshopper, and I've never seen a locust, but I've seen plenty of grasshoppers, and I've seen pictures of locusts. They're the same thing, and they eat up everything in sight. Grasshoppers are actually not even mentioned in Exodus. Only locusts are, according to Gill. So, this is locust. And now in verse 47, "God destroyed their vines with hailstones and their sycamore trees with frost." Now, there were a lot of sycamore trees in Egypt, and those trees just were a symbol for all the other kinds of trees in Egypt. In other words, according to John Gill, all kinds of trees were killed in Egypt, not just the sycamore tree. Now, Adam Clark describes the sycamore tree this way. "This tree was very useful to the ancient Egyptians, as all their coffins are made of this wood, and to the modern Egyptian, as their barks are made of it." Barks are their boats. "Besides, it produces a kind of fig on which the common people in general live. And Mr. Norden observes that they think themselves well regaled when they have a piece of bread, a couple of sycamore figs, and a pitcher of water from the Nile. The loss, therefore, of their vines and sycamore trees must have been very distressing to the Egyptians." In other words, God hit them in their breadbasket. God hit them where it hurt the most. Verse 48, "He gave over their cattle to the hailstones and their herds to bolts of lightning." Now, this is described by Moses in Exodus 9:23 this way. So Moses stretched out his staff toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail. Lightning struck the earth, and the Lord raised hail on the land of Egypt. So the lightning probably fritzed the cattle. Lightning, as you know, when it hits the ground, can kill whatever it strikes. Now, an interesting translation here. Oftentimes, lightning is called fire. In fact, if we look at Exodus 9:23, in the New American Standard, I just read from the Holman Christian Study Bible, which said lightning struck the earth. But if you go to the NASB and read it, it says in Exodus 9:23, fire ran down to the earth. So lightning and fire seem to be the same thing. The NIV, as well as the Holman Christian Study Bible, also translates the word as fire. The NASB has lightning. It just shows fire from heaven is usually lightning, and I like to use lightning because we can picture that better. Usually you think fire from heaven. What is that? We think of a campfire, yellow tongues of fire flickering from the sky somehow. And no, that's not what it is. Asaph continues with God's destroying ways concerning the land of Egypt in verses 49 through 51 of Psalm 78. God sent upon them, upon the Egyptians, his burning anger, fury, and indignation and trouble, a band of destroying angels. He leveled a path for his anger. He did not spare their soul from death, but gave over their life to the plague, and smote all the firstborn in Egypt, the first issue of their virility in the tents of Ham. Now, God did all this terrible stuff on Egypt using a band of destroying angels. Asaph says in verse 49, the KJV, instead of destroying angels, says evil angels. John Gill says, well, the angels were evil, but not in themselves. They were so called because of the evil that they brought. The NIV goes along with the NASB and translates it as destroying angels. Well, who were these destroying angels? They could be demons, or they could be angels of God. Some people even say they could be Moses and Aaron, translate angels as messenger, destroying messengers. Moses and Aaron breathed fire and brimstone down on Egypt, which they did. Adam Clark says it's impossible to say of those three options exactly who these angels were. God says he leveled a path for his anger. I like that metaphor. He cleared out the path, made it smooth, so he could barrel down that path and aim himself right into the midsection of Egypt. He did not spare their soul from death, but gave over their life to the plague, all the plagues that, well, that would be the 10th plague, the one that killed all the firstborn in Egypt. Verse 51, smote all the firstborn in Egypt, God did, the first issue of their virility, the firstborn of the Egyptians, in the tents of Ham. Now, that expression is strange. What is a tent of Ham? Well, a tent of Ham, or land of Ham, is an expression which refers to Egypt. As the NIV Study Bible points out, here's some scriptures that point that out. Psalms 105, verse 23, the author of which is unknown. Israel also came into Egypt. Thus Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. Well, Egypt there is in parallel with the land of Ham, so that proves that Egypt is the land of Ham. Psalms 105, verse 27, same psalm, authors unknown. They performed his wondrous acts among them and miracles in the land of Ham. Psalm 106, verse 22, the author of which is also unknown. Wonders in the land of Ham and awesome things by the Red Sea. So obviously Egypt is the land of Ham. Now, why? Well, one of Ham's sons was called Mizraim. We read that in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, verse 6. The sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. So Ham, one of his sons, was called Mizraim, and in Hebrew, Mizraim means Egypt. So that more or less clinches that issue. If I recall from the Table of Nations, the sons of Ham spread out over Africa anyway. And of course, Egypt is in Africa. We go now to Psalm 78, verses 52 through 55. But he, God, led forth his own people like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them safely so that they did not fear, but the sea engulfed their enemies. So he brought them to his holy land, to this hill country which his right hand had gained. He also drove out the nations before them and apportioned them for an inheritance by measurement and made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. Now, Israel here is compared to sheep. As John Gill says, sheep are, quote, weak, timorous, unarmed, harmless, and inoffensive. And that's how the Israelites were, I guess. Weak and timorous, unarmed. Well, they weren't really unarmed. They had arms. But the idea basically is they didn't know how to use them well because they were helpless out there in the wilderness. So they were guided like a flock of sheep in the wilderness, so that they did not fear. Now, John Gill says Israel feared for a little while they were at the edge of the Red Sea, but they didn't fear after they entered the Red Sea. I don't know if Gill's right about that. I'm telling you, if I was an Israelite, even though I saw the Red Sea part, and I'm walking between two walls of water, and I hear the wind blowing and the thunder and lightning going, and I got Egyptians on my tail, and I'm not going to fear? So I think what the psalmist means is that they didn't fear the Egyptians. They didn't fear getting caught because they were getting out, and it was obvious that miracles were happening. They didn't fear occurred mainly at the point when the sea engulfed their enemies in verse 53. But the sea engulfed their enemies, that's when the waters closed over the heads of Pharaoh's army. That's why they didn't fear, because Pharaoh had gotten wiped out. Verse 54, so God brought them to his holy land. Notice that the Bible calls the land the same way we call it today. We call it the holy land. That's a biblical term. It's not just something somebody made up. To this hill country, the Holy Land is called hill country. If you'll look at a map, there's a spine of hills that runs right up and down, north to south, in the center of the land, and that's why it's called a hill country. Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it refers to Mount Zion in particular, to this country of the hill, I guess you would say, Mount Zion. I don't think so. I think it's just talking about hill country, which his right hand had gained. God's right hand is his strong hand, because speaking anthropomorphically, a person's right hand is usually, unless he's left-handed, is usually his strong hand. And so right hand came to be a symbol of strength, and God's strength had gained the land of Israel for the Israelites. In verse 55, God drove out the nations. The seven Canaanite nations listed in Deuteronomy 7:1 are the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. When I was back in Deuteronomy 7, I mentioned all these tribes. The best ones to remember, of course, are the Amorites, because they were the big dogs. They were even beyond the land of Canaan. They were the red-headed guys, the guys that didn't look very Semitic, pale faces. And then, of course, Canaanites were often given the name for the whole area, too. But we won't go into all those details, and not only that, we need to note that in some list of the Canaanite nations, there were more than seven mentioned. There were some other minor tribes mentioned, too. But all of them were pagans, God-haters, blasphemers, idolaters, and God drove them out. Now, let's talk about a big theological problem here. How was it just for Israel to take other people's lands? They are living there, living peacefully, got their little Irish setters and their picket fences, and their cute little kids and their dresses, and they're living peacefully, and all of a sudden these big nasty Israelites come in and wipe them out. The Israelites didn't care about land titles, contracts, the legal system that these Canaanites had. They didn't compensate the Canaanites for taking the land. They just took it. That shows that God is an unjust God. This, of course, is what the pinheaded, well, I shouldn't say that. They're not pinheaded. This is a legitimate question that many skeptics of the scriptures have, and it needs to be answered. So let me give you some answers, not all of which are mutually exclusive. Some are overlapping. First, God was executing justice on the Canaanites for their gross immorality, and they were just getting what they deserved. Remember, the Canaanites were famous for idolatry, child sacrifice, ritual prostitution. Let me read some verses that show that. Leviticus 18:21. You shall not give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. Molech was a famous Old Testament deity that required you to pass your child through the fire, which most people take to mean you got to sacrifice kids to this idol. Numbers 25:1-5, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. This is right at the end of the 38 years of wandering in the wilderness there on the east of the Jordan in the land of Moab. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. The Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. Now you will notice that God executed Israelites just like he executed Canaanites. It wasn't a matter of God favors the Israelites over the Canaanites. It's a matter of, are you going to continue sinning in such a gross way that you're about to wipe out the name of God from the earth? And he didn't care whether it was Israelites doing that or whether it was Canaanites doing that. He wasn't going to put up with it. Not only that, this was a minor judgment here in the plains of Moab? How about when God sent the Israelites into exile in 586 or the northern Israelites in 722 BC? That was a bodacious judgment. So don't feel sorry for the Canaanites when you consider what God did to the Israelites. But still, you have a problem. Why is God so mean? Well, look, a just and sovereign God can do what he will when executing justice. Now, the NIV Study Bible here has got what I consider to be an extraordinarily weak comment. Quote, Israel's conquest of occupied land rankles those who pay rent and taxes and fight wars to protect their land. The fact that God ordained it makes the Israelites' imperialism only slightly more palatable. Well, this is a Christian talking about the Israelites, the NIV Study Bible. I don't have a problem thinking it's slightly palatable. A just and sovereign God can do what he will when executing justice. I mean, would this scholar who made this comment in the NIV Study Bible complain when God wiped out the Nazis? Or Pol Pot? Or Mao Zedong? Now note, in this conquest of Canaan, as Israel drove the Canaanites out, note how God's justice was mitigated. Non-Hebrew believers in God were not stripped of their possessions. They prospered as they lived with the Israelites. Now, they were, in some cases, the Israelites were allowed to wipe the cities out, but in other cases, they weren't. If I recall, if they were outside the land of Israel, they couldn't kill the men, women, and children, but if they were inside, they could, because that was the area where the Canaanites would expand and wipe out the Israelites, so the Israelites wouldn't have a land. But once the wars were over, and as we know, the Israelites did not wipe out all the Canaanites, because a lot of them were left. In fact, they were left in contradiction of God's command, but they were still left, and they prospered as they lived with the Israelites. So they weren't all wiped out, which is sort of a mitigating factor. The fifth thing we need to say about this is that God had to clean out an area on the moral cesspool called Earth to make a place for his Messiah. The Messiah had to come somewhere, and it was Israel, and Israel had to have a place, and the Canaanites were in the way. And these people were sacrificing their kids to idols and basically living a horrible life. They got what they deserved. Let's read what Paul Copan, he's a professor somewhere in Florida, if I remember correctly, evangelical guy, and I think I read something about his take on this that I didn't think was all that convincing, but this is a good quote, I think, here, about how God had to prepare Israel. Second, God was able to prepare a land for his people to create the proper religious setting to make sense of a coming Messiah who would bring redemption to Israelites and Gentiles alike. Who are the intended recipients of this salvation? Jews, yes, but also Israel's most hostile enemies, Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, and Philistia. Now, that's something that critics often forget. Yeah, the Canaanites were wiped out, but their descendants had a chance to become a part of the people of God, either as proselytes in the Old Testament people of God or as Christians in the New Testament people of God. Copan continues, and I hope I'm saying his name right, I don't know. What is more, God even incorporated the Canaanites into the new Israel, the true people of God. And Copan quotes Zechariah 9:7, which I will read. I, God, will remove the blood from their mouths and the detestable things from between their teeth, which is an Old Testament way of saying I'm going to make them pure and holy. Then they, referring to the Philistines, too, will become a remnant for our God, for they will become like a clan in Judah and Ekron like the Jebusites. So even as the Jebusites lived among Israel and Jerusalem, so the Philistines did too, and they will be clean. They will be Levitically clean, which is symbolic of spiritually clean. They will become like a clan of Judah. So that is a prophecy of the conversion of pagans who were in the land, the Philistines who were in the land. Copan goes on to say, killing the Canaanites was not racially motivated. Of course it wasn't. It was theologically and morally motivated via divine mandate. Back then, people didn't worry about, oh my gosh, you know, you said something that offends me. You're a racist. You're a worthless piece of scum because you were born with white skin or whatever. They didn't do that back then. They weren't going after the Canaanites because they were a different ethnic group. They were going after them because they were idolaters. Going on to talk about this driving out of the Canaanites, this is a historically non-repeatable event so that no one should or should have used it to justify other invasions. Now that should be obvious. This was a particular situation where God was establishing the Israelites, but that doesn't justify other invasions. For example, the Europeans' invasions of America. And I'm not saying these invasions I'm going to list here are necessarily right or wrong. People are going to move. I mean, all of history of Europe is about the barbarians moving all over Europe trying to find a place to live. So I'm not saying that, but here's some examples we can say. We can't say, well, you know, the English and the Dutch invaded North America, or the Spanish invaded South America, and the Portuguese. And they did that, and it's okay for them to do that because the Israelites invaded the Canaanites. That would be improper. How about the Afrikaners? The Dutch Afrikaners invaded the Transvaal in South Africa and set up their nation of South Africa, which eventually became the apartheid nation of South Africa. The labor government down there in the 1940s didn't want black workers competing with white workers. I say that because I don't have fond feelings for labor unions in general. But that the Afrikaners could say, well, we invaded down there because, you know, the Israelites invaded the land of Canaan. How about Israel's occupation of Palestine in 1948? Ooh, now that might be a little closer to home because we're talking about Israel. Can Israel say that justifies our occupation of Palestine? No, now that occupation of Palestine could be justified on other grounds. That's a nice political argument, of course, which I'm not going to get into, but we can't use the scripture to justify that. How about the medieval crusaders when they invaded the Holy Land after the Muslims invaded it? The Muslims can't say, well, you know, Israel invaded Canaan, so we're invading Canaan too. Of course, the Muslims aren't going to say that, but they invaded it, and so then the medieval crusaders went back and invaded it. Well, that has nothing to do with the Jews invading Canaan. Now, here's one of my favorite examples. Can Northern Americans justify invading the South in the Civil War, as in the Battle Hymn of the Public? I think it's Julia Ward Howe. Mine eyes have seen the fires of 1,000 flickering camps, or whatever it is. His truth goes marching on as the Northern armies come down there and burn down my grandmother's farm and go through Georgia, marching through Georgia, burning everything and inside, raping the women. Well, that's okay, because that's a righteous army doing its righteous Christian things. And after all, the Jews invaded Canaan. Well, that's absurd. This is a one-all thing. God had a particular reason for driving the Canaanites out of that land. We also might point out that Abraham had claimed the land 500 years earlier because God had promised it to him, as the NIV Study Bible says. So Abraham's claim was prior to the Canaanites. But that was just a claim. That doesn't really satisfy me too much. That reminds me of the Indians and the Native American Indians in America. They would look out and they would say, I claim this land all the way to the moon or all the way to California from Missouri or whatever. And then another Indian tribe would do the same thing. And they didn't have land titles. And so the tribes were constantly fighting each other and killing each other because they made land claims. Well, the same thing with Abraham. I mean, he claimed the whole land. That doesn't really solve anything to me. Besides, there were Canaanites living there when Abraham was there. Seems like those Canaanites would have had a claim to the land too. And not only that, was Abraham's claim extensive to all the borders of Israel? Seems to me like he could legitimately claim only the area around Mamre where he bought land. He bought land near Shiloh and he bought land near Hebron, the Oaks of Mamre. Well, sure, he bought that. Okay, no problem. But to claim the whole land all the way from the river Euphrates down to the Wadi of Egypt? No, I think you're going to have to say God in his justice decided that the Israelites were going to live there. And if you don't like that, you can be a skeptic. You can be an atheist. You can go put yourself up higher than God. You can virtue signal all you want about what a great righteous guy you are. But God's got the right to do what he wants to do. And he is perfectly just in doing it. Now in verse 55, Asaph says that God apportioned the nations for an inheritance. In other words, Joshua went out and laid off the boundary line so that all the Israelites could get an inheritance. Made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. That means in the tents of the heathen, not in the tents of the Israelites. The Israelites dispossessed the Canaanites and dwelt in their tents. In other words, they went into their home and they took it. We go now to Psalms 78, verses 56 and 57. Yet they, that's the Israelites, tempted and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned back and acted treacherously like their fathers. They turned aside like a treacherous bow. Now the they there that did this is Israel. They tempted and rebelled against the Most High God. There is no other God higher than God, so he's the Most High God. They didn't keep his testimonies, that means the law of Moses, but they turned back and acted treacherously like their fathers. I assume here that Asaph is referring to Israelites who came after the Israelites on the Exodus, the fathers being those who were on the Exodus. I'm assuming the psalm was not written too far after David or Solomon's time, so it would be during the times of Joshua, during the times of Saul. The Israelites are still acting treacherously. They turned aside like a treacherous bow. The NIV has like a faulty bow. The NIV Study Bible says that the word faulty indicates a slack bow, a bow that cannot shoot an arrow, a bow that is unreliable. I don't think so. I got a better explanation than that. This is from Adam Clark, who knows everything. He's second only to God in his knowledge of things in the world, the great polymath. He was an Arminian. He didn't understand that, but, you know, you can't have everything. Now, this is a great quote here. What Clark is trying to say is that a treacherous bow is a bow that you take and you bend it backwards in order to string it. Now, I don't know why you need to bend a bow backwards in order to string it. It seems to me like you'd bend it in its natural direction to make the ends closer to each other so you could string it that way. But he says you bend it backwards, and the bow is treacherous because when you let it loose, it can be pretty dangerous. So let's read Clark's quote. The eastern bow, which when at rest is in the form of a curved figure, must be recurved or turned the contrary way in order to be what is called bent and strung. If a person who is unskillful or weak attempt to recurve and string one of these bows, if he take not great heed, it will spring back and regain its quiescent position, in other words, its position at rest, and perhaps break his arm. And sometimes I have known it, when bent, to start aside and regain its quiescent position to my no small danger, and in one or two cases to my injury. So naturally, Adam Clark just doesn't know about this. He's actually got one, and he's testing it out to see what it's like to have a treacherous bow. This guy really is an amazing guy. He injured himself so he could write a commentary. This image of the treacherous bow is frequently used in the sacred writings, but no person has understood it, not being acquainted with the eastern bow, the curved figure, which must be recurved or bent the contrary way in order to be proper for use. If not well made, they will fly back in discharging the arrow. It is said of the bow of Jonathan, it turned not back, did not twist itself backward. This is in 2 Samuel 1:22. It was a good bow, one on which he could depend. Hosea 7:16 compares the unfaithful Israelites to a deceitful bow, one that, when bent, would suddenly start aside and recover its former position. And Clark mentions Jeremiah 9:3 also, referring to that. So what is the point of all this metaphor? Adam Clark says that Israel, when bent by God to his purposes, sprang back into their former natural state. So verse 57 would read, they turned aside like a treacherous bow. They went back to their default position. Rebellion against God. We go now to Psalm 78, verses 58 through 61. For they provoked him with their high places and aroused his jealousy with their graven images. When God heard, he was filled with wrath and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he abandoned the dwelling place at Shiloh, the tent which he had pitched among men, and gave up his strength to captivity and his glory into the hand of the adversary. Let me back up and say that in verse 57, when the Israelites turned back and acted treacherously like their fathers. The fathers were the Israelites in the wilderness during the Exodus, and now the Israelites who are acting treacherously are those who are acting treacherously in the time of the judges. And that is more particularly described in verses 58 through 61 when we see the tabernacle taken away from Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas in Shiloh, which happened at the time of the judges later on, so they are still sinning just like they did during the Exodus. They're still sinning during the times of the judges. And during the times of the judges, they provoked him with their high places, aroused his jealousy with their graven images. When God heard, he was filled with wrath and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he abandoned the dwelling place at Shiloh. Well, the dwelling place is the tabernacle, which Joshua had set up at Shiloh. And years had gone by, 300 years, the time of the judges. At the end of that time, we have Eli presiding over the tabernacle at Shiloh, which is at the tribe of Ephraim, and his two sons were the priest ministering to the tabernacle at the time, Hophni and Phinehas. Now, the tabernacle was abandoned there. Now, what does that refer to? That refers to the battle of Aphek / Ebenezer. Remember, the Philistines came to Aphek. The Israelites twice, went to Ebenezer once without the ark, the second time with the ark. They fought the Philistines and got clobbered, and the Philistines took the ark. They took the ark, but the tent stayed at Shiloh. But it was still said to be abandoned. It was abandoned because God wasn't there anymore. The ark was gone, even though the tent actually stayed there at Shiloh. Let me read what Adam Clark says about that. Quote, "The tabernacle which Moses had constructed in the wilderness remained at Shiloh even after the ark was taken by the Philistines and afterwards sent to Kiriath-Jearim. From Shiloh, it," not the ark now, but the tabernacle, "was transported to Nob, afterwards to Gibeon." This is Saul doing that, apparently under the reign of Saul, and it was there at the commencement of Solomon's reign, for this prince went thither to offer sacrifices. So the tabernacle stayed at Gibeon all the way through David's reign, all the way through Solomon's reign. From the time in which the temple was built, that was during Solomon's reign, of course, we know not what became of the tabernacle of Moses. It was probably laid up in some of the chambers of the temple, and it was probably destroyed when the Babylonians came and wiped out Israel in 586 BC. So that's the history of the tabernacle. It was abandoned. It was either hidden when the Babylonians came, or was more probably, in my opinion, just burnt up. And so God has abandoned the dwelling place that was at Shiloh, just like he says in verse 60, like Asaph says. Now, this is a rabbit trail, but let's talk about what happened to the ark after the battle of Aphek/Ebenezer, where Hophni and Phinehas were destroyed by the Philistines. The Philistines took the ark, not the tabernacle now, but the ark, took the tabernacle first to three Philistine cities. First to Ashdod, then to Gath, to Ekron. They were moving it because, remember, the ark was causing all kind of calamities to fall on the Philistines. So those are three Philistine cities. When it was in Ekron, then they decided we want to give the ark back to the Israelites. So they sent the ark to the land of Judah, first to Beth Shemesh, and then a little bit further north to Kiriath-Jearim, which is to the north, northwest, I think it is, of Jerusalem, where it stayed there until David took the ark into Jerusalem. Remember when everybody's dancing and carrying on, and Michael looked through the window and said, "David, you're making a fool of yourself dancing so much because the ark has come back to Jerusalem." The ark was then put in what I call David's tabernacle. David made a special tent for it. Moses' tabernacle still stayed at Kiriath-Jearim. The next thing that happened was, is the ark was put in Solomon's temple. We read in 2 Chronicles 35:3, he, that's Josiah, King Josiah, said to the Levites who taught all Israel the holy things of the Lord, "Put the holy ark in the temple built by Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, since you do not have to carry it on your shoulders. Now serve Yahweh your God and his people Israel." So I don't know why Josiah was putting the ark back in the Solomon's temple, but he did put it into Solomon's temple, so we know it was there. And then, of course, the Babylonians came in 586 BC and wiped out the memory of the ark, probably wiped out the ark physically as well. And after that, the ark is lost, and we have the famous legends of the lost ark, as in Harrison Ford, Raiders of the Lost Ark. At any rate, the whole story is an abandonment of the people of Israel and their holy places because of their sin. Verse 61, Asaph continues his psalm and says, "And God gave up his strength." His strength refers to the tabernacle, the tent. "Gave up his strength to captivity." Well, it refers to the ark. "And God gave up his strength," i.e. his ark, "to captivity among the Philistines, and his glory," that's the glory of the ark, "into the hand of the adversary," the Philistines. Parallelism there, it's repeated. So the ark is called God's strength and his glory. There is another psalm which refers to the strength and glory of the ark. That would be Psalms 96:6, the author of which is unknown. "Splendor and majesty are before him," before God. "Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary." Well, what's in God's sanctuary? It doesn't say the ark, but the ark is one of the major things in the sanctuary, and that thing is called strength, and it's called beauty, which is close to glory. Perhaps that psalm was referring to the ark that was in the tent, because of Psalm 61, the ark is called strength and glory. We go now to Psalm 78, verses 62 through 64. "He," that's God, "also delivered his people to the sword, and was filled with wrath at his inheritance. Fire devoured his young men, and his virgins had no wedding songs. His priest fell by the sword, and his widows could not weep." So we continue now in the cycle of God being gracious to Israel, Israel sinning and abandoning God, and then God punishes Israel, and then Israel repents, and on it goes. Right now, we're in a cycle of judgment, punishment. Also, God delivered his people to the sword. That would probably be by the Philistines who whipped up on Hophni and Phinehas at the Battle of Aphek/Ebenezer, the two battles there. Let me read 1 Samuel 4:10. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. This is at Aphek/Ebenezer. And every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. So you see, it was a whopping big defeat. God delivered his people to the sword, and was filled with wrath as an inheritance. The children of Israel are called the inheritance of God. Psalms 33:12, which is written probably by David. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen for his own inheritance. And of course, we are the New Testament people of God, so we are an inheritance of the Lord. In other words, we not only inherit the blessings of the kingdom, but we are an inheritance to God. He inherits us. Verse 63, Asaph says, fire devoured God's young men, and God's virgins had no wedding songs. Now, when did fire devour the young men of Israel? Some people say perhaps Nadab and Abihu, the two sons of Aaron who were toasted because of their offering strange illegal fire on the altar. But I don't think so. Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown say this refers to the destruction of the Israeli army, the Israelite army, when the Philistines took the ark. I just mentioned that. 30,000 people wiped out under Phinehas and Hophni at the Battle of Aphek/Ebenezer. In between Aphek and Ebenezer is where the battle took place. Now, if that were the case, the fire would probably be symbolic. Fire devoured as young men. This is poetry, so it could very well be symbolic. No actual fire is reported to have struck the Israelites in that battle. But Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown allows for a possible literal fire. It's either a figure or a literal burning, he says. It goes either way, he says. Verse 63, God's virgins had no wedding songs. That's because all their soldiers were killed in the war. So they couldn't get married and have a song at their wedding. Verse 64, his priest fell by the sword. That is probably Phinehas and Hophni, the two priests of Eli who were fornicating at the gate of the temple. Little scumbuckets. They fell by the sword. They got killed, and his widows could not weep. Let me read to you about how the widow of Phinehas, who was hanging back at Shiloh with father-in-law Eli, 1 Samuel 4:19. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, that's Eli's daughter-in-law, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was taken and that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. Her father-in-law, Eli, died when he got the bad news of the defeat and fell off his stool and died, if you recall the story. As John Gill points out, that even though she lived after her husband Phinehas was killed in the battle, she didn't even notice Phinehas, much more she didn't weep for him. She only lamented that the ark had been taken. So in Psalm 78:64, and Asaph says that God's widows could not weep, Asaph is probably referring to 1 Samuel 4:20-22, about the time of her death. This is the widow of Phinehas. The women who stood by her said to her, do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son. But she did not answer or pay attention, and she called the boy Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband, father-in-law Eli and her husband Phinehas, having been killed. She said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken. So she only cared about the ark. She didn't care about the fact she was a widow. She didn't care about the fact that her husband was killed, probably because he was fornicating with young maidens at the door of the sanctuary. Who knows? But the widows weren't even weeping. The widow of Phinehas was not even weeping for her husband, but she was weeping because of the lost ark. We go down to Psalm 78:65-66. Then the Lord awoke as if from sleep, like a warrior overcome by wine. He drove his adversaries backward. He put on them an everlasting reproach. God is said to be as if he was sleeping. In other words, he was asleep when the Pharisees took the ark. He didn't do anything about it. Well, of course, that's speaking very anthropomorphically here. God doesn't sleep. Like a warrior overcome by wine, like a warrior that's drunk. He wakes up, he looks around. Oh my gosh, the ark's been taken. And so God jumps up. He drives his adversaries backward. Now, other translations of this backward driving of the adversaries. The NIV says God beat back his enemies. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says the Philistines never regained their position after the defeats by David. And that's true. A few years after we get past the time of the judges, past Saul, David's king, and he ends up putting the Philistines to bed. Now I'm going to give you a great translation from the King James translation. The NASB says that God drove his adversaries backwards. The King James says he smote his enemies in the hinder parts. Now Gill and Clark, who are using the King James version, they say that the Philistines were smitten with hemorrhoids in their hinder parts. As John Gill puts it, they had piles in their posteriors. Now, isn't that great? So the King James is really good for some archaic English. Language is funny when it gets translated from one language to another. Gill is referring, of course, to the famous incident when the Philistines were afflicted with piles in their posteriors, 1 Samuel 5:6. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. That's when they took the ark into their city of Ashdod. And so in verse 66, God put on the Philistines an everlasting reproach. Now, when did that everlasting reproach come upon the Philistines? We have a couple of options there. When their idol Dagon fell, their fish god, in 1 Samuel 5:3, this is in Ashdod, same Philistine city, in the Philistine plain there. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place. Again, you recall the story, just to summarize, Dagon finally fell and chopped his head off on the threshold. So that was pretty embarrassing if you're a Philistine. How about the Philistines' golden hemorrhoids and the golden mice? They were probably saved by the Israelites to the Philistines' perpetual reproach. Now, if you recall, the Philistines, in an act of sympathetic magic, since they were afflicted with hemorrhoids and the mice were eating up their fields, what they did is they made gold hemorrhoids and golden mice to offer to their gods that they might take away the hemorrhoids and the mice from the fields. But they finally decided, we're going to give these hemorrhoids and golden mice, these golden hemorrhoids and golden mice, to the Israelites, 1 Samuel 6:8. Take the ark of the Lord, place it on the cart, and put the gold objects that you're sending him as a restitution offering in a box beside the ark. Send it off and let it go its way. This is the priest of the Philistines telling the Philistine leaders what to do. Put the golden hemorrhoids and golden mice in a box, put it beside the ark, and get it out of town. So the Israelites would have these things, and they could say, look at these Philistines. They gave us golden hemorrhoids and golden mice. That's pretty much of a reproach, an everlasting reproach. That means a reproach for a long, long time. We're going out of Psalm 78, verses 67 through 68. God also rejected the tent of Joseph and did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. Now, this rejecting of the tent of Joseph, this is not an eternal rejection. This has nothing to do with the philosophical question of election and reprobation. This has nothing to do with the Calvinist-Arminian debate. This is talking about a temporal rejection of the tent of Joseph. Now, Joseph, of course, refers to Ephraim. Joseph's two sons were Ephraim and Manasseh, Ephraim being the tribe that took the preeminence and, in fact, was the largest of the, or the most important, I think it was the largest also, tribe of the northern 10 tribes. So Ephraim is often put for northern Israel. And so God rejected Ephraim. In fact, the parallel part of verse 67 shows that the tent of Joseph is the tribe of Ephraim, because that last part of verse 67 says God did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. Why? Because of Ephraim's sin, which we've just talked about, the desecration of the tabernacle during the times of Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. And so the ark got stolen, and later on Saul took the tabernacle and put it down at Gibeon, at Nob, and then from Nob to Gibeon. And so the ark and the tabernacle have been removed from the north, removed from Ephraim, and given to Judah. And that's what is being referred to here in verses 67 to 68. God rejected Joseph, i.e. the northern 10 tribes, and he chose Judah, the southern tribes. He did that by moving the ark and the tabernacle away from Ephraim in the north, where Shiloh was, down to Judah in the area around Jerusalem. Mount Zion, which he loves, so Mount Zion here refers to probably the whole tribe of Judah. It's loose. Mount Zion can be either the city of David proper, the city of David plus Mount Moriah in the north, or it can refer to the whole city of Jerusalem. It can refer to the whole land of Israel. Here it sounds like it's referring to the tribe of Judah. Basically, Mount Zion is where God dwells with his people. Great symbol, because it's used in the New Testament, as you know, in Hebrews 12. Now, this rejection of Ephraim, I told you very apodictically that it referred to the stealing of the ark and the loss of the tabernacle from Shiloh, but other people have suggested other things, and Gil refutes and denies every one of these other options because Ephraim was rejected a lot. Option number one that's denied by Gil, Ephraim was rejected as being one of the tribes of Israel. Obviously, that's not true. They were one of the tribes of Israel. Option number two, when they were rejected when they split from Judah and Benjamin at the time of Jeroboam I, the famous division between northern and southern Israel after Solomon died, Rehoboam in the south, Jeroboam in the north. Is Ephraim is rejected? No, that's not what it's referring to. Or it could refer to the northern 10 tribes being beat by Assyria in 722 when they were conquered and taken off into captivity. Gil says, no, that's not referring to the rejection of Ephraim. Or it could refer to Saul being chosen as king when the seat of government in the time of the judges was removed from Shiloh, which is in Ephraim, in the times of Joshua. Well, it was put there in the times of Joshua, and it stayed there all during the times of judges, and then Saul took it down to the south and put it in Jerusalem. So Ephraim is one rejected tribe, are they not? But I don't think that's what this is referring to. This is referring to the Battle of Aphek Ebenezer, that horrible defeat when the ark was stolen. And Jerusalem was chosen in verse 68, not only as the head of the civil government, but also as the place of religious devotion to Yahweh, the chief place. We go down to Psalm 78, verse 69. And he, that's God, built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth, which he has founded forever. Now, the sanctuary that he built, of course, would be the temple in Jerusalem, as Gill and Clark say. God built that temple like the heights. Mountains are very stable and very secure. That's probably what's being referred to here by the heights. Like the earth, which he has founded to ever. Of course, the planet is going to be here for a long, long time. Well, if you think about it, when you take the earth as it's released from its bondage to sin and decay and reestablished as a place for the saints, well, then the earth's going to be here forever, eternally. But forever, of course, could be for a long, long time. And earth could also be translated as land, like the land of Israel, which God has founded forever, founded for a long time because God made a covenant with Israel. And the covenant of Israel, Abrahamic covenant, of course, applies to the new covenant too. And so that would be eternal. The land of Israel, the land he has founded, eternal. But anyway, that's a minor point. The point is God's forever, the sanctuary is forever, God is forever. We go down to Psalm 78, 70 through 72, and we will finish this extremely long psalm. He, that's God, also chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds, from the care of the ewes with suckling lambs, and he brought them to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. What Asaph is doing here, he's saying, look, after all this judgment on Israel, God shows mercy. God chose to show mercy to the people of Israel by giving them a good king, King David, who took care of them, which he did. For the most part, he had some glitches, the Absalom rebellion, Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittite, but he was basically a very good king of Israel. God took him from the sheepfolds. 1 Samuel 16:11, and Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children? That's Samuel the prophet going down to David's dad, Jesse, down in Bethlehem and saying, we need to find a king. Show me your kids. One of them's going to be kid. One of them is going to be king. And Jesse says to Samuel, there remains yet the youngest, and behold, he is tending the sheep. Then Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. And David was chosen. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finally finished Psalm 78, and we are prepared in our next audio to go to Psalm 79, which is a lot shorter, 13 verses. We will call Psalm 79, How Long, O Lord? Sounds like a great psalm as we undergo the desecration of America. I hope to see you for that psalm, and I hope you enjoyed this one.